Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name is Jazza.
My name's Jimmy.
And we together speak weekly on topics that interest us, that the news and things. I think I'm actually getting worse at describing what we do every week.
We'll say it's because it's late on a Sunday and you're tired, you know.
Yeah, it's been a long week. I was joined by Lewis Parker last week, but now Jimmy's back. What was your break about, Jimmy? I actually have no idea what you went and did.
I went and saw my sister in Edinburgh.
Oh, so. That's quite nice.
Yeah,
oh,
it's lovely, okay. Isn't it? Yeah.
No, sweet. Very nice. But you're back this week, and we are going to be talking about three topics, as we do every week, and we'll probably last between 45 and 60 minutes.
Yes.
First of all, we are going to talk about the Autumn Statement, where George Osborne basically pulled the rug out of everybody's feet and is actually going to be a not evil Chancellor for the next season.
I thought you might be overstating the extent of this change, but yeah, that's roughly true.
Well, everybody seems to be very convinced that he's actually a lovely man now. Second of all, we're going to talk about COP21, which is the summit that they're having in Paris at the moment on climate change, which today, which is Sunday, has seen thousands of people coming out and protesting across the world, right?
That is right. What does COP actually stand for?
Oh, I don't know. Why do you always ask me these things?
Fuck's sake, Jazza.
COP21. What do you stand for? You've got me Googling things within the first, 2 minutes. Why are you... Convention on Climate Change? No, that doesn't stand for that.
It Conference of the Parties.
Yeah, okay, we'll go with that.
Yeah. It is. It says, you know, that's real. I don't know what that is. Conference of the Parties the name of the climate change sort of group that's trying to coordinate climate change between countries?
See, all you're doing, Jimmy, is reinforcing how little we know about all of the topics that we talk about.
I don't want anyone going into this thinking that we're a valuable and trusted news source. That would be disastrous for everyone.
It would be. Take everything we say with a pinch of salt. And then finally, we will be talking about one of my bays, Katie Hopkins.
Well, what's happened in the world of Katie Hopkins this week?
Katie Hopkins went to Brunel University, and rather than being unplatformed, which is what happened, has been happening to quite a lot of right-wing commentators across the country, including Jermaine Greer, which we covered a couple of weeks ago, instead of being unplatformed and told that she can't come to the university, a load of students turned up to her talk on the welfare state and then just walked out. Cash.
Very rude. Very rude. They turned their back on her first and then they walked out.
How dare they?
It is outrageous. Another egregious attack on freedom of speech and everything this country stands for, etc.
Precisely. Shall we listen to some music and get into it?
We probably should, yeah.
George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer and possible future Prime Minister, this week laid out his plans for spending over the next few months in his Autumn Statement, which actually I found out has only recently become a thing. There used to be only an annual statement, and it was because Gordon Brown loved hogging the spotlight so much that it became a seasonal statement.
It's a good fact.
Good fact, yeah, you're welcome. Good. Yeah. So the main thing that kind of has grabbed the headlines is the fact that he's decided to completely scrap the idea of scrapping tax credits, which has shocked people quite a lot. He had a huge amount of pushback when he tried to push that through the Commons a few weeks ago. And now it turns out that we're not going to have it at all. And he's saying that we don't have to suffer such strong cuts in that particular sector.
So with the tax credits, why were people so against them, for our listeners who don't remember?
Because it was going to make a lot of working families a lot worse off. The average family were going to lose £1,600, I want to say, a year. And lots of people were saying that, especially at a time when wages aren't really rising at the rate of inflation, it would have pushed a lot of people into quite a lot of, maybe not poverty, but into tougher times.
Well, I think poverty is probably the right word, actually, because tax credits are a form of subsidy for low wages. Yeah, I mean, you can, you know, as Jeremy Paxman once said, being balanced doesn't mean you have to not tell the truth, you know. these tax credits were a genuinely bad idea, and that is why Tories rebelled against them, and Labour and the Lib Dems in the House of Lords actually vetoed them effectively.
So this was seen as like a big victory for kind of like the moderates and the opposition and the Lords even. And one would imagine that George Osborne having to do a U-turn would actually make him look really weak and make him look terrible. Correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I get the impression that he's actually come off of this like butter wouldn't melt in his mouth.
I think there's two reasons for that. Part of the reason he was able to scrap the tax credits reform is that the Office for Budgetary Responsibility, which is an independent economic forecasting unit within Whitehall, said that we were going to get far higher tax receipts than was previously said.
Yeah, because the economy is doing better, right?
Yeah, basically. Although some people have said that these forecasts are maybe not as accurate as they might be, and that, you know, some months down the line we'll find out that we didn't get this like windfall in terms of tax receipts.
It is dependent on the economy doing well, right? But also, this is because the reason that Osborne is deciding to make these cuts is because they've decided that they want to have a surplus by 2020.
Yes.
And there is a lot of kind of conflict in intellectual circles as to whether or not this is actually something that we need. Are you convinced by that yet? Because it certainly seems like, well, we voted in a majority Tory government. It seems like the public has been won over to that idea, right?
I'm slightly more from the point of view that the government should now be borrowing money to invest. Generally, with public finances, if you're going to get a better return out of the economically speaking, if you invest in education or transport or what have you, it's probably worth doing that. When the Tories originally came into power, there were far more concerns about how secure the UK was in its finances and whether the huge amount of debt that we had, which is something like £1.6 trillion. Was a liability in the sense that we might actually default on our debts. And now there isn't really so many concerns around that. But I mean, you could look at it another way and say, now that things are good, we really should be cutting down on the debt so that when things become bad again, which they inevitably will, we won't get caught out in that position again. So
yeah, that's certainly the impression of the kind of like the narrative that is being sold to the general public. As well, I want to talk specifically about the political capital that George Osborne should have had to spend by doing this U-turn. He should, all things considered, he should have come across after this kind of U-turn as somebody who was quite weak and somebody whose ideas were being pushed back. Whereas actually, it seems like he's been painted and is being perceived as quite compassionate for doing so and quite pragmatic. How has he gotten away with it?
Well, I said earlier there were two reasons why he's got away with it. One of them is that we have higher tax receipts. The second one is how badly John McDonnell, who's the shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, responded to Osborne's speech. I'm assuming you've already read all the stories around this
little red book.
I mean,
I was just shocked. This is terrible that we have such a uncredible opposition, right?
Mm. Well, what surprises me is that John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, they're literally career politicians. They literally haven't really done anything of any great substance. Like, they've both worked in trade unions and for some other basically political campaigns, but like they've both been politicians for certainly in Corbyn's case more than two decades. I think John McDonnell joined the House of Commons in 97, and yet they're so bad at politics. They just don't understand how things will be perceived and presented in the media when they do things, which is why, I mean, George Osborne, when he, just after the Red Book incident, stood up and said the Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer has literally just read out from Mao's Little Red Book from the dispatch box. And
he didn't need to spin that in any way, shape or form. Yeah. It's damaging enough as it is. And there's been talk of the fact that McDonald's trying to do this in order to call attention to the fact that Osborne is selling off everything to the Chinese. And I think that, Jimmy, you explained that really well a couple of episodes ago on The Right Dishonourable, how that kind of perception isn't necessarily very true.
Yeah, but actually,
it's clearly just come across as absolutely nutty, hasn't it?
Yeah, what John McDonnell was doing, like, there's actually a vein you can kind of pick there, because people do actually feel quite strongly about having national assets sold off to foreign companies. Yeah. People feel badly about that. And that's what John McDonnell was trying to do. And if he'd done it skillfully, he could have really actually got something out of that. But as I said, he like sucks at politics. He just doesn't seem to have the talent and the skills of media manipulation that Osborne and Cameron have. So
this comeback from tax credits and the apparent titanium shield that Osborne has at the moment has kind of been what the main focus of the tax credits is. What has kind of been missed in the mainstream media when it comes to this Orban statement, do you think, Jimmy?
Well, bearing in mind that most of the things I say are going to be things that I've read in the mainstream media, but things of...
Nobody needs to know.
Okay, these are all things I found myself, personally.
Take all of the credit, bro, it's fine.
One of them is actually quite interesting, is actually the... Osborne's like cut down the amount of short money for non-government parties. This is a type of subsidy, basically, that if you're the main opposition party, Her Majesty's opposition, you get given a certain amount to allow you to campaign and allow you to provide an effective opposition. Osborne's cut this money down, so actually Labour is even more disadvantaged than when they were beforehand, and that's kind of been ignored. Like, there's, you can read certain articles and people pick up on it, but there's a lot of little changes like that.
Is that also going to affect, because every party kind of gets an allowance for the MPs that it gets elected into the lower chamber, right? Is that going to affect like the Greens and the Lib Dems and
it affects all of them. It's not just Labour. It's just that obviously Labour have the, aside from the Tories, the largest number of MPs, so it affects them the most.
I am very conscious that occasionally we are quite, I don't want to say anti-Tory, but pro everyone else, is how I'm going to spin this. But they're basically trying to make it so that the next election is even more of a walkover than it's going to be if Corbyn is leading it, right? Because we're going to be redrawing the boundaries in the next couple of years, and they're going to basically draw the boundaries so that they have more safer seats, and the like. We're going to be stuck with these guys for a while, right?
I think only because Labour are quite ineffective. That, like, when you actually look at the success of the Tories, it's very much overstated, especially at the last general election, because everyone thought that they were going to flop and Ed Miliband would have a decent chance at regaining power.
Yeah.
The fact that they managed to form a majority government kind of skewed the way we've actually perceived them. Like, the Cameron and Osborne, they're effective in the sense that they've managed to hold on to power, but they haven't had a stronghold on power by any means. And so the difference between Labour and the Tories in terms of their general position, I think, is less than is commonly perceived. If Labour found an effective leader, someone like, say, Chakaramuna or Tristram Hunt, in terms of their general presentation, actually managed to find a new narrative to sell to the British public, I don't think it would be that hard for them to win a general election.
So I think we need to stop talking about people like Tristram Hunt and Chakaramuna.
I mean, I was just using them as examples, but you
yeah, but just because that there was a poll that was released this week of Labour, the Parliamentary Labour Party, the MPs, and the wider membership. So the membership being the main people who voted for Jeremy Corbyn in that massive landslide of over 60%, and it's going to be very difficult to bring in a new leader without their consent. And so like saying that they're going to go back to the right anytime soon is just ridiculous. I can see them perhaps selecting somebody else from the left of the party, probably somebody who is currently in the shadow cabinet with Corbyn, to be honest. There was a really interesting thought piece, and yes, I am going to call it a thought piece.
I mean, in the old days we called them opinion pieces or comment pieces, which was fine, you know.
So there was a thought piece in BuzzFeed.
Well, was it from a thought leader, though?
It was like a juxtaposition in terms of it.
no comment.
About the possibility of somebody like Hillary Benn stepping into those shoes, who is generally more widely respected across the party. But yeah, it is going to be interesting.
Well, the points you made
say that he wasn't going anywhere.
The points you made are all fair, but it's all to do with Labour's internal party problems. I don't think there's a fundamental problem in terms of Labour capturing the electorate's attention, if you see what I mean.
Mm. Although, I don't see what you mean. What do you mean by capturing their attention?
In the sense that the Labour brand actually still has value, and probably, well, there's something a bit crude about talking about it as a brand, but if Labour managed to regain some sense of economic credibility and actually elected a leader that the public could actually feel positive about, there's nothing really stopping them winning a general election. There's nothing fundamental in the way, in terms of like the demographics of the UK, that would make that impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I mean, if we look at a party like, say, UKIP would never be able to win a general election because their appeal is too narrow. They always focus on the white working class demographic, which just has less like soft power generally, but also as a proportion of the UK is just way too small for them to actually ever grab power. Whereas I don't think that's true of Labour.
So as always, Jimmy, we've managed to turn a talk about something vaguely political into when is Jeremy Corbyn going to leave, which I swear is whenever we talk about domestic politics.
I mean, there are other points to the budget that we could go through. There's going to be no cuts to the police.
Yeah.
They've increased...
Which was also another really interesting political play by Osborne, because the shadow Home Secretary, Andy Burnham, had said that he would only cut the police by half of what was originally proposed by Osborne, and so Osborne has kind of trumped Andy Burnham in that sense, which is a bit of egg on Labour's face as well.
I guess I don't think most people follow politics closely enough to actually realise that'll be a thing.
You're very right. But also I feel like part of me thinks, is Osborne going full Russian and just kind of giving like a horrible kind of prospect of something really bad politically happening, like scrapping tax credits and cutting funding to the police, just so that he can take it back later on, so that he looks like a lovely guy?
I don't think he would have had as many goodies to hand out if he hadn't had that change in forecasting from the OBR. And as you say, like the Tories' overall objective of actually running a surplus by the end of this parliament hasn't changed. And I don't see any reason why it would change. So, yeah, I think your analysis is pretty much spot on, to be honest.
Oh, I've knocked it out of the park once again.
Yeah.
Was there anything else you wanted to talk about the budget?
There was this thing about the stamp duties increased, which is a rare occasion where the Tories have actually worked against the interests of private property holders. Stamp duty is it's increased by 3% for buy-to-let and second home buyers. So for those who don't know, when you buy a house, you pay stamp duty, which is just a one-off tax, but can actually hike up the price of the house quite a bit because of the sums involved, basically.
Yeah.
and the Tories are generally seen as the party of property holders, but this is, it's kind of an interesting change, and no doubt it will piss off some people who are actually affected by it. But it won't substantially alter the housing market.
Are never going to end up, those people who are going to be affected by that would never think about voting for Labour.
Yeah, yeah. So in that sense, it's quite a canny move. Osborne's also said that he'll build 400,000 new affordable homes by 2020.
I cease to believe whenever somebody talks about affordable homes anymore. I mean, it's like, of course.
I mean, 400,000, you know, he's not going to hit that target, so he might as well have been far more ambitious and said, you know,
$3 billion for affordable homes for all.
There's so many problems in the way that the housing market works in England to do with planning permission and that sort of thing, and just NIMBYism in general, so it's probably meaningless, that number.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything else that, unless you know, you got something else to say.
No, nothing else. I've just had a lovely time chatting with you, Sir Jimmy. If you guys have opinions on the autumn statement, if you think that we missed anything, then please do let us know on Twitter. You can interact with the podcast at Right Dishonor. It's a sentient Twitter channel. Neither of us do it. It just has its own brain, honestly. Although you can also tweet at me and Jimmy. I'm on Jazza John, and Jimmy's on JDE Nichols.
Indeed.
Good. Over the next few days, there are going to be a number of really important world leaders converging on the city of Paris to talk about climate change and to hopefully come to an accord of reducing the amount of carbon emissions and just basically making our environment a better place. It's called COP21. What does COP stand for again, Jimmy?
Conference of the Parties.
Excellent. So a lovely, vague name for you there. And this comes off the back of a number of of large international like climate change conferences that have essentially fallen flat on their face, right?
Yep, pretty much. That's why you know, the world is slowly burning and we're all going to die horribly.
Yeah, so I have my own kind of like opinions on how. Can I just confirm? We both appreciate that climate change probably is a thing, right?
No, I'm very much taking the Republicans' view on this, that it's all been made up and there's an international conspiracy.
Right, Bart? Jimmy, why don't
you? I'm joking.
You'd be
Come
so
on.
Good at that.
Yeah, but like, there's a certain amount of that being that ironic all the time. I think it would change me.
It would destroy your soul.
Yeah.
So we both appreciate that. Well, we both believe, as most scientists believe, that climate change is a thing and that it is caused by man-made causes.
I mean, to quote John Oliver, we side with the overwhelming scientific consensus on this issue.
We do. We're flying the flag in that manner. I think we're very brave. Why do these conferences then keep on failing when the majority of the scientific community say that this is something that we need to act on internationally?
I know you're like playing devil's advocate here, or just like posting an obvious question, but the obvious answer is that we've built an economic system that is sort of reliant on burning oil, or, you know, converting oil into energy, and that's bad for the environment, and pretty much nobody wants to stop
burning,
you know,
oil.
Yeah, no, I mean, the trouble you have is that you have developed countries which are in a better position to actually start using more renewable energy sources, but the countries like India and China, which are only going to grow steadily more powerful and influential, need to modernize. They actually need to use these non-recyclable forms of energy, and so there's a huge conflict there. But also, if you're in this position where you're making big changes to reduce your carbon emissions, but no one else is, you kind of, it's like a game theory thing. You just sit there and you think, well, what's the point? I might as well just join in with everyone else.
Yeah, precisely. And also, I feel like in terms of like the grand international scheme of things, it is so difficult for you to get a consensus on such a wide, on such a huge spectrum of like political standpoints, right? Most people with half a brain believe that this is clearly going to be an issue, but nobody really wants to be the person to put their head above the parapet unless you're like Finland.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other problems is that America, as we've alluded to earlier, is one of those countries that doesn't really, that is divided on the whole climate change issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Republican Party substantially denies that climate change is a problem, that humans are causing it. And that means that because the US is obviously the most powerful country in the world, that severely limits the ability even of presidents like Barack Obama, who do believe in the scientific view on climate change, it limits their ability to actually do anything about the problem. So
there's many people that are calling COP21 as kind of like the conference that is going to spell the end for the fossil era, I think is something that I read in the Telegraph.
Really?
Which seems overly optimistic. Have you seen anything that you think like actually backs this up, or is my pessimism over the whole thing kind of justified?
Well, probably the most apocalyptic description I wrote of it, and I think this was in The Economist, although I might be wrong about that, but somebody said that this was actually in the Financial Times, is that the modern world is going to turn the developed world is going to turn into a country of a country like the Netherlands, where everybody has to rely on artificial dams and stuff to actually stop sea levels from just destroying coastal towns.
Or they're going to move, right? This is just going to end up causing another huge migration crisis.
Probably not with countries that are able to install those defences and adapt, but it's going to cause huge migration crisis.
It's going to be most affected by these environmental changes that we've been seeing. And so I kind of have... Do you want to hear how I'm going to fix the thing, Jimmy?
I mean, everyone does. You know, we've all been waiting for your considered response.
So I think that the climate change that we're experiencing, and the rising of sea levels and the increasing of our global temperatures, are inevitable now. I feel like politically it's there's no way that we're going to be able to find a way of reducing it so that we don't go past the 2% rise in global temperatures, which I think is the goal by the UN to stop irrevocable damage to the environment.
Yeah, a lot of people, to be fair, have criticised that target as kind of meaningless, and even people who support it say they just support it as a target for its own sake. So
it's really good to have a target.
It is nice to have a target, that's true.
Yeah. It's very good for forward planning. So basically, I feel like we need to accept that this isn't going to stop. What is clear, and that I think everybody can agree on, is that the world's climate is changing. This is something that you can see. You don't have, in order to kind of like realize that, you don't even have to appreciate that it was man's fault that the climate is changing. You just need to realize that the climate is changing, we are becoming warmer, and that is going to cause a lot of people, especially in the developing world, to not be able to live on the land that they live on now.
Yes.
I think that we need to start, rather than having lots of these lovely plush events every few years that end up being really lovely for the delegates because they get to go to loads of really fancy dinners and have selfies with President Obama. We need to be investing money in kind of like the crisis plan for how we're going to deal with these masses of people and the masses of species that are going to possibly become extinct, and invest in solutions to what is going to be the inevitable outcome of climate change, rather than trying to stop climate change happen.
Well, we're doing such a fine job of sorting out the current migration crisis that I'm sure, you know, we'll be fully prepared when 100 times its size rolls around in the next couple of decades.
I know, right, Jimmy? But the thing is, I'm not in charge of the migration crisis right now. I feel like my speech just then really just kind of paints me as the obvious candidate for president of the world so that I can fix this whole thing.
I'm sure that will work. I'm sure that will go your way.
I'm originally being rather exasperated about this whole thing, but there are lots of people who are genuinely hugely concerned about this. There were thousands of people taking to the streets in protest of not in protest of the COP21 meeting, but kind of trying to raise awareness of the problems that we're facing with climate change. Do you like? Is this in? Are those kinds of protests in vain?
I have to admit, I'm a bit skeptical about protesting in general. I'm not really sure what it achieves a lot of the time. I mean, there are obvious examples you can pull out, such as like the poll tax protests in the UK from Thatcher's era that actually did achieve something, but they achieved something in conjunction with other political action that was taking place. Yeah, I mean, obviously support people's right to protest, but I'm having actually attended lots of protests, you know, for the right to dishonorable, I'm not really sure what they achieve, and I'm not really sure these protests for these, you know, COP21 are going to achieve very much as well.
Well, so we're very flashy about, very optimistic about the whole thing, aren't we?
I think like some sensible measures will probably be agreed, but as I said, I think there's fundamental disconnects in terms of the way that the developing world views it and the developed world views it. There's conflicts between India and China, which need this energy to modernize, versus the US and Europe, which obviously are in a better position to actually adapt because we've already modernized. But it's not as if everyone's being selfish. I mean, we don't just use energy for frivolous things. We use energy to actually power hospitals and schools and that sort of thing. So there's no way of actually reducing our energy consumption without lowering our quality of life. I think it's all bad.
Do you think that there's a possibility? So obviously, the powers that be are going to implement my plan in the next few years.
Obviously, yes.
Do you think that there are other areas where we can perhaps kind of like cushion the blow in terms of the blow to the environment? So I'm just thinking about stuff like deforestation. Do you think that's something like that, and perhaps things like electric cars and the investment of renewable energy? Do you think those are battles that can in the long term be won?
Yeah, I think so. I guess it's just a case of whether you think we'll win those battles in time to actually avert serious disaster.
I mean, I feel like we will, because when there is serious disaster, I think that we will have no choice but to adapt, right?
Yeah, I mean, one thing the developed world has actually done is effectively pay poorer countries to actually enact some of these policies, so like subsidize, like paying the money so that they won't deforest quite as fast and that sort of thing. And I think those sort of programs are generally a good thing, and I think we should probably do more of them, because it's the only way to kind of fairly spread the burden of cutting down on carbon emissions and that sort of thing.
There are many people that would say, and many of my friends from China would say this, that those kinds of policies actually mean that the developing world is going to stay developing, because you're stopping them from being able to go through the same kind of mass industrial revolution that the West was able to go through, burning as much fossil fuels as they want. I feel like that's a bit shitty, quite frankly, and I think that if we are going to shoulder any kind of a burden, it needs to be on those that are broadest. So,
but the thing is, there's just like less that, say, the UK can do when compared to China. But I mean, apart from everything else, China is the world's manufacturing centre. So there's obviously industrial processes that they do on a scale that we can't even really comprehend.
Yeah, but still, they only recently overtook the US in terms of gas emissions.
Yeah, I suppose it is unfortunate, because as you say, historically the places like the UK that had the earliest industrial revolutions did do all the things we are now criticizing China and India for doing. But by the same token, if they don't change their behavior, then there's not really going to be a sustainable world for them to modernize into. So, you know.
Yeah, boom. What about that, China?
Yeah, we await China's responses on the back of a postcard.
For some reason they seem to not be keen to engage with us at the Right Dishonourable, but you can engage with us on the Right Dishonourable.
That was a good segue.
Thank you so much. You've ruined it by saying how great it was, though. you can go to the website, rightdishonourable.com, and leave us a comment. We do love it when you leave us comments. We get ever so excited, and we text each other frantically, being like, oh my God, somebody's left a comment on the website. So feel free to do that also. Make sure that you leave us stars and reviews on the iTunes store.
And try and spell Jazza's name right, because he's not called Jazzy.
Somebody called me Jazzy and it was the sweetest thing ever. Thank you for trying. Anyway, into the next segment, right?
Right. This week, Katie Hopkins was, you know, rudely denounced by a collection of Brunel students who first turned their back on her while she was speaking at a debate on welfare, and then later walked out of the auditorium, making a lot of fuss and hullabaloo. This is like the latest we've seen in a wave of kind of student protests looking to no platform, controversial speakers that maybe don't jive with the views of the student unions at these particular universities. Jazza, what do you make of this latest development in that longer story?
Well, I think this, more than anything, was really... It was quite interesting to see that the student group... it was actually the student union who decided to stage this kind of walkout.
Yes.
And they were very deliberately trying to not ban her from speaking on campus. Like, I have a quote up here from... Ali Milani, who is the SU president at Brunel. She said that it was the conversation was at no point about banning Katie Hopkins from speaking, and saying that she has the right to speak, but that they wanted to show their discontent with her views. And I think that this is quite an interesting way of doing actually something very similar to non-platforming her, basically.
I just, like, I see that view of Ali Milani is just bollocks, really. I mean, in the longest statement from him, he describes Hopkins as an individual who publicly utters overtly bigoted views. And I feel that does kind of suggest what I said earlier in this podcast, that this basically was a political attempt to silence someone who, you know, who has views that the student union doesn't agree with. And I feel that they've said, like, we wanted to provoke a discussion on no platforming, yada yada yada. But
which they have done, to be fair, right?
They have done, but no, the whole point about no platforming is that it's about silencing dissent, basically. It's about trying to rig the debate so that people who have views that you don't like are not able to debate. It's not censorship in the old form, in the sense of, like, state censorship, where, you know, the thought police come round and arrest you and take you off to the dungeons to have you tortured or anything.
Do you think that, speaking in the wider sense rather than just the Hopkins case, do you think that there is ever any justification in no platforming somebody who is perhaps invited to speak at an event like this?
I think there's kind of another interesting trend that seems to be running alongside this one, and what I'm talking about is Theresa May, the Home Secretary's fight against extremism on campus, and the move to actually prohibit extremist Islamist groups from speaking at universities and trying to convert the students to their cause. And while some people are taking a very strong line on, oh, we shouldn't be banning people like Jermaine Greer or Katie Hopkins from speaking at these events, there's not really the same pushback when it comes to Islamists, because people, I think, see it as quite a different issue. And
yeah,
from my point of view, it's actually the same issue.
So Hopkins, regardless as to whether you agree or disagree with her political views, and you can read her political views in the Daily Mail on a regular basis, but it's, I feel like it's, she still does have, she just has a different opinion of how the world should be. And although she has said some really horrible things specifically about refugees, there's lots of people who do share her views on stuff like welfare, on stuff like immigration, and on stuff like health and the role of the state and those kinds of things. Do you think that this is kind of like a wider, I don't want to say problem, but kind of phenomenon in kind of like student circles of, oh, these people have different views to us, therefore they shouldn't be given a legitimate voice?
This is like a slightly Freudian kind of analysis of their way of thinking, but the argument, like the stereotype between left and right, is that people on the right think that people on the left are stupid, whereas people on the left think people on the right are evil. And that kind of dichotomy is very much what you're seeing here, and it's why that people,
you know, I agree with both of those viewpoints.
Explain why do you agree with both of those viewpoints?
I think that you and I, Jimmy, are relatively in the center ground when it comes to politics in general.
So we're mildly stupid and mildly evil, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think that the people that are to the extremes of both of those, and people call it left and right, people call it socialist and
liberal and conservative in the US.
Yeah, exactly. But there's kind of like this tribalism that is basically, anybody who's ever done any kind of social science study knows what confirmation bias is, and it's just kind of like, oh yeah, my tribe is great and glorious and amazing, and the guys on the other team are just terrible and they don't know what they're talking about or they're evil, and it's just so plainly stupid. Because the only way that you're ever going to be able to get any kind of consensus is through compromise. And this kind of just reinforces the lack of compromise that is kind of being encouraged by non-platforming or protesting by walking out. Because frankly, at the end of the day, when they've walked out, they have refused to partake in a debate. And I always feel like, partake in the debate, and if you think that you're right, win the fucking debate.
Yeah, but the view that some of these censorious students have is that they're not interested in winning the debate, they're just interested in silencing somebody whose views they view as kind of toxic and potentially harmful. They kind of draw a line between Katie Hopkins calling refugees cockroaches, and they think that that is the cause of so much antipathy towards refugees in the UK. Whereas actually, I see it as the other way around, is that the reason she can write those things is because there is an audience for those kind of views. I don't think most columnists, I don't think, really convert people to their cause. They're mostly just preaching to the choir, far as I can make out.
Because nowadays you have to either choose to buy the newspaper, or nowadays more likely to click on the content, right?
Yeah.
And so, to what extent? So, this isn't. Do you think that this is a new thing? Or have we just been blissfully ignorant to the fact that, like people who don't have the same kind of more broadly left-wing views as the majority of the student population? Do you think that this has kind of always happened, or do you think that it's just kind of been more? Do you think that it's been amplified by the fact that we live in a world where our social circles are kind of even more pronounced by the fact that we have Twitter circles that we follow? We saw this after the general election this year in the UK, where everybody on Twitter seemed to be absolutely shocked that Ed Miliband didn't win an overwhelming majority. People were like, oh my god, how could this happen? It's like, well, because you haven't actually been acknowledging and talking to the people that have different views to you.
Did that happen en masse? I feel like,
certainly in my Twitter sphere, which probably says more about my Twitter sphere than anything, people were like shocked and blown away by the fact that Cameron got a majority. And I think,
to be fair, even the pollsters were kind of shocked that Cameron got a majority, you know, in defense of your friends.
Yeah, but I think that it was, people were more shocked by the fact that anybody could possibly think about voting Conservative.
Well, to answer your question, I don't think that social media has necessarily made politics more polarized. I think that it's just made it more obvious that people do actually surround themselves with forms of media that, you know, agree with their broad worldview. which has always happened to some extent. I think the reason we're seeing more of these protests from students is because they now have the means to actually broadcast themselves, or maybe narrowcast is actually a better way of putting it, because most of the people they're speaking to are part of their congregation, as it were. But with newspapers, it means that you can pick up a video like the one posted of the Brudel students walking out of Katie Hopkins, and you can post it online, and then the Independent will pick it up, the Guardian will pick it up, the BBC will pick it up, and it will become a story. Whereas 10 years ago, that wouldn't have really happened, because the technology to actually record and broadcast these things just wasn't there, and the internet culture in terms of how newspapers operated was also not there. So those are the changes I think that has made this more prominent, even if, or has made it appear more prominent, I should say.
Do you think that I'm right in saying that this shows a lack of willingness to debate people who have different views to them? And do you think that do you think that that is what's actually been, that's what's actually happening in these kind of events?
To be fair, in the case of like Katie Hopkins, I don't really think she is worth debating, because she has her views, and you could argue she's a troll to a certain extent, which is to say that she's not saying things necessarily because she believes them. She's actually saying them just to wind other people up. That's actually what a troll means, despite the wider array of uses that the media has put on that word. But yeah, the students, ironically, given that they've gone to university to be exposed to new ideas, are not willing to be exposed to new ideas. They just probably describe themselves as, you know, I'm left-wing, I'm open-minded, but they're very closed-minded as far as the views of the right wing are concerned.
We've also kind of seen with universities the increased use of stuff like trigger warnings in course notes, basically.
Yes.
Which also, I think you've criticised this by also narrowing the scope of debate that is kind of being offered in certain education establishments. Do you think that that is also a wider part of the... do you think that that's a wider part of the phenomenon that's kind of happening with this narrowing of the debate that is being willing to kind of happen, take place on our universities?
It's part of the same problem, in the sense that it relates to this hyper-awareness of the consequences of language. Mm-hmm. To an extent that I think is unreasonable. Obviously, language has consequences, and the way things are portrayed does affect how people think about it, but it seems to me that the sort of students that push trigger warnings and actually try and shut down speakers they don't like have this kind of mystical view of how language works, as though somebody can say something and then it just, you know, there's a huge chain reaction, and, you know, at the other end people die. Whereas actually I think it's far more mild than that. I think people overestimate the effect of newspapers in, say, Sweden general elections, whereas most of the research suggests that people just tend to buy newspapers that confirm the views they already have. So the British didn't need the Sun to tell them that Ed Miliband was a bit dorky and a bit goofy. They, as soon as they saw a picture of him, they made up the minds themselves, you know.
And I think they simply reinforced that and gave them a reason to actually believe it.
I don't think it gave them a reason to believe it. It did reinforce it to a certain extent. But people who thought that Miliband was unsuitable to be Prime Minister, it didn't matter how many nice editorials you could have put as many nice editorials about Ed Miliband saying what a wonderful guy he was in front of them, it wouldn't have changed their mind that he was suitable. And I feel that broadly applies to a lot of things in politics.
What do you think are the wider implications of this? What do you think is going to be the kind of consequences of what seems to be a more closed-minded attitude towards the right wing, and also to kind of the broader debate when it comes to campuses?
That is actually a really good question. I don't have a glib response. Ooh, for
may,
you.
May I answer my own question?
Yeah, please do.
I loved it. So I feel like Corbyn, I know we've already talked about him on this podcast, but I feel like Corden is kind of the manifestation of the consequences of that. don't you think? Like, people who have voted for him and who joined the Labour Party en masse have kind of thought that it's the best idea ever. Whereas they've kind of forgotten the fact that they need to win over an electorate that won't necessarily have the same views as them. And so that's meant that the Labour Party has is becoming less electable by the fact that there's these people who believe that anyone who has a disparate view to them is evil or is too willing to compromise or weak.
Well, earlier on you mentioned some of the comments we get, and it does seem that if we write or say anything nasty about Corbyn, there is a chance that somebody will message us telling us what bastards we are, basically. And we don't really get that when we insult, you know, the Tories, which, as you said earlier, we do far more than we insult Labour,
yeah.
I think. Partly because they're in government, so there's just more material.
Like, I feel like we call Corbyn unelectable at least once an episode.
But, I mean, that really is a statement of fact at this point. Yeah. that's definitely going to get us in trouble. I don't know, yeah. I feel the point you've kind of made is that these kind of attitudes have kind of balkanized our discourse, both like in terms of the media and just in terms of how politics functions as well. And the only thing that that's going to do is it's going to actually drive a wedge between different demographics and different groups in society. And we might end up with the kind of fracturous politics that you see in the US, where everything's dysfunctional, the political system doesn't work, you just have crazies on all sides of the media that just cannot have a reasonable discussion with one another. That's a kind of catastrophic interpretation of what's happening, but I think we've already seen milder versions of that problem, particularly in the way, like, say, SNP supporters view the mainstream media. Like, yeah. They just do not trust
any
newspaper in London.
Yeah, the SNP, I think, is another example of that kind of closed offness to a wider debate. You're either with us or without us. And that only gets kind of amplified by the fact that confirmation bias is a thing. And if you're with us, you're with us. And if you're not, then you're evil and you deserve to burn in hell. Which is a very extreme way of kind of putting what I think that these people, what goes through these people's heads. But in the grand scheme of things, I feel like it does make us weaker.
Mm, indeed. I feel like we've probably covered this in enough.
Have we covered this enough now?
We've also referenced Corbyn, which is, you know, we have to do at least once every topic.
I know, so. And we've done it like twice over the past like 45 minutes or whatever.
When he finally gets sacked, we really should do a Corbyn special and relive all our favourite Corbyn moments.
We could do, oh my god, we could do a clip show over the holidays. It would be great. I actually want this to happen now. If you want that to happen, let us know on Twitter. Go to twitter.com.
You're really shit at this.
I'm tired now.
Okay, so we need to let Jazza go to bed. So if you have something rude to say to either one of us, go to writedishonorable.com or find us on Twitter at writedishonor. You can find me at JDE Nichols, and you can find Jazza at Jazza John.
You can also send us nice things as well if you like. Those are also welcome. We always expect people to be really nasty to us, but I don't think that's always the case. Some people like my hair.
Do they?
Some of them do.
He has a man bun at the moment.
Occasionally, and then I take it out and it flops and it's like really adorable.
Alright, we're definitely rambling at this point, so I'm going to cut us off.
Bye everybody.
Bye-bye.